Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast here on Reality TV for Hap-Ups. Hey, everyone. Mike Bloom here for a spooky, scary edition. You know, Halloween has come 8 months early, and we have fallen in, much like a marzipan man, into your podcast feed to talk about this episode, last pre-finals episode of this Top Chef season. First, let me bring in the panel who's going to talk through this episode with us, someone who... it would be my worst nightmare if she was not on the podcast with me every week to break down this season. Haley Strong. Haley, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm feeling loose. I took a couple shots of red rum before coming on here today.
Good. As long as you didn't do it backwards, then I think we'll be completely fine. And we are joined by a very special guest, someone that I know is a huge Top Chef fan. And you know what? This season, we got to encapsulate some of their journeys in the course of this episode. This season's been like a speeding car that's just been blazing a trail. I think it's time that we put this car in park, or in Rourke, if you will, if only one podcast. Please welcome Survivor 35 contestant and Top Chef superfan Rourke Luskin. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been just living for this for quite some time now.
And thank you for not hanging up as soon as I made reference to definitely the stupidest thing I've ever said on recorded footage.
No, I love it.
Are we sure about that, Mike? Like, is there a top 10 list out there that we can pick from?
You know, someone out there has a top 10 list that you're just waiting to drop. Well, we're so happy. I'm so happy to have you. I mean, I felt like the stars were aligning once I listened to First One Out and you made a gyms reference, not just a gym reference, but a gyms specific reference. I knew we had to have you on at some point, but some out there might not necessarily know that you are a really big Top Chef fan. So to start things off, I would just love to hear from you. You were sort of Top Chef resume or background, if you will. When did you get into the show? You know, who do you love? Who do you not so love, etc.?
Yeah, so I watched pretty much from the beginning because I believe the production company is Magical Elves, which did Project Runway. And mm-hmm. I worked in fashion for some time and it was a big hobby of mine as a kid. And so it was cooking. And so when we saw that this was like another show that Magical Elves was doing, I was like, okay, this is going to be legit. And I think I really think I started with season one. And I am kind of shocked that it has made it for so long, because unlike Project Runway, we can't taste the food, whereas you can see the clothes. And so that thing, that makes a lot of sense to me that it is successful. But Top Chef, I'm so glad it's still with us. And the caliber of chefs has only grown exponentially. I would say, to start off negatively, and then we'll end positively. My least favorite is Josie.
Oh, yes.
Which I think we all can agree.
I'll even forgive the fact that you invoked her name. Just
I know she who must
you
not
were
be named.
In so
I'm
much
really
agreement
sorry.
With those of us that started on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even going to get into it. And I love, you know, recency bias. As everyone knows, I love gyms. I want to get to this later, but I really appreciate any person, and definitely reality TV people, who are clearly really comfortable in their skin. And like Jim's is really comfortable in his skin. And so I loved Carla Hall. I loved Antonia. I was like an Antonia truther. I've never really been like a big Blaze person. And so I like really wanted Antonia to beat him. And anyway, but yeah, no, I love it all. Do you guys remember? I don't even remember what his actual, the blonde guy. It was Blank Beach Club. I don't want to say the word. We're gonna get there.
Are you thinking of Jeff, the surfer guy from season 5? That's when I heard Beach Club. That's the first thing that I thought of.
Yeah, he was a blonde guy who had a place in Miami, and every time you see his chyron, it looks like Dildo Beach Club. It's like Dillido or something. It's awful. Like that guy I will never forget him. I don't really know what else he has done, but great character, great TV character.
He just gets special mention just for the fact that what his restaurant might actually look like.
Exactly. Well, that's like Philip Shepherd level, like chyron excellence, in my opinion. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, I love this. We're getting things like right off the bat into the craziness. To just go with the craziness of this episode. So I've been so intrigued to hear then. So you've been with the show from the beginning. We can definitely sort of unpack what you've thought about the season so far as we've progressed through. But I mean, we don't have really any veterans to talk about. You know, we start off with four via LCK, but to see Leanne come back, someone that you haven't seen on your screen since season one, did that sort of fill the pangs in your nostalgia-filled heart?
Well, I also really enjoyed her from the Cooking Channel show. I think it was Best Thing I Ever Ate.
Mm-hmm. I remember that one.
And she was, I think, one of the original people on that show, and that show was quite good for a minute. but yeah, no, and I loved Kwame. Kwame is another one. I was trying to pull his name on the beach with Josh, and we both sat there like fools, like looking at each other for about 3 minutes, and we were like, we should move on. But I love Kwame.
Okay, so let's get behind the scenes. And how, you know, Josh only edited together a bit of you and him talking during first one out. How much talk revolved around Top Chef, you know, trading Top Chef inside jokes when you were on that beach?
Oh, pretty much like the first 5 to 8 minutes, I would say. Not like too much, but yeah, I'm such a fan of you guys as content creators that I was like, I'm not important. Let's just like have a conversation about like you. And I was just way more into that and hearing from you guys than anything else. I don't need to talk about myself. I don't care.
You is smart, you is kind, you is important, Mark. And you were actually
and you
is actually right as well, because I'm looking this up. Chef Jeff McInnes was indeed the chef behind Delito Beach Club, which does look
thank you
very, very lascivious if you blur your eyes just a tiny bit. So
yes,
you good call out there. Nice deep pull. Well, all that said, you know, we're getting to the late stages of season 15 as well. This seems to be our last pre-finals episode, as I mentioned before. We'll definitely talk about the circumstances behind that. So sort of tying a bow onto our time in Denver, Haley, I know we talked last week about why are they spending so much time in Denver. This week we took a little bit of a side trip to Boulder, but how did you feel this episode was overall in terms of a nice sort of like, this is the end of one stage and the beginning of another in terms of this Top Chef season?
This episode felt a little weird for me. I don't know why. It's felt a little janky in all aspects, and I think we're going to get into it a little bit later, especially in the quick fire. We had some janky editing, and then we had some like a elimination challenge that was kind of a little too loosey-goosey, and maybe I just wasn't paying quite enough attention to the episode, which is very possible, but it was just kind of like it felt a little off to me for whatever reason.
What did you think about it, Rourke?
I know what you mean, Haley. I think that like, typically, these sort of big inspiration challenge elimination ones are just sort of more moving and sweeping. And like for me, you know, going back again, like a challenge I will never forget is the Ellis Island challenge.
Is that only because that's when Mike, Isabella and Antonia, your fave, found out that they were distant cousins?
Yeah. I mean, that was amazing. But, you know, like seeing their parents, thinking about their personal history, like that's really, that's great TV. That's moving. And I just think that, like, even though I really like these people, I just didn't really feel that connected or inspired to any of it. Maybe because they all were sort of like, oh, God, okay. You know, like they didn't seem that inspired by it.
Yeah, this was a weird episode from a temperament perspective, specifically with Bruce. We're definitely going to get into the nitty gritty of it all, but it feels like Bruce, the past couple episodes in particular, has said, you know, I really want to see my son. I just wish I could see my son. And you could feel his head just sort of get pulled out of the game more and more. And this really was sort of the breaking point where in both of these challenges, Bruce sort of came in with the attitude like, do I have to? Okay, fine. I probably enjoyed this episode more than both of you did. I actually liked both of the challenges in concept, and we can definitely get into it a little bit more. I will say the editing was very interesting this episode as well, besides the big sort of elephant in the room or ghost elephant in the room that will come with the quickfire challenge. I mean, there was some stuff dropped at the beginning that, you know, there has been some talk about, has Top Chef gotten too predictable with its editing? And I do feel like with this episode, when you start off with Bruce saying like, hey, my confidence is shot, you know, I don't really feel like I'm doing that well anymore, even though we do get some sort of red herrings from Chris a bit later on. I don't know. I personally felt throughout like this was going to be Bruce's episode to go. Haley, did you feel the same way? Were you as surprised with the results?
Yeah, no, this was exactly what I was expecting. He had a really rough quick fire and then a really rough elimination challenge. It was kind of just like, oh, Bruce, like, just keep fighting. And he was just kind of, he was tired. He his mind was elsewhere, and he's been putting, you know, off those thoughts for so long. And now that he's so close to the end, it's hard to kind of focus in on that almost.
Mm-hmm. Well, up to this point, Rourke, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the season in general. You said that you like these people. Did you have any particular favorite challenges or chef testants that will stick out, you know, in the Rourke Luskin's Top Chef Hall of Fame?
Oh, I mean, I love Fatima so much. It's just ridiculous. As you guys know, so I'm a therapist at a hospital. And so a lot of ways, like I see really terrible things. I don't cry at work, obviously. And so people make fun of me, but I'm a really big fan of a scheduled cry where, like, you know, like, you're ready for it and you just, like, do something that facilitates it. And so if I ever want a scheduled cry, I just look at Fatima's Instagram and, like, think about, like, what it would be like to be, like, 28 and so successful and, like, have cancer and, like, be beating it. And, like, I just, like, totally am able to work myself up. And so I just adore her. And I think that, like, far more important than a reality show is the fact that on the same night she got eliminated, she learned that they removed the entire tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So, like, blessings be with her 100,000%. And then to make it more fun again, sorry, I went there. Something else that I texted Haley. I was like, thank God I didn't do last episode with you guys. It would have been a depression zone because losing Flam and Fatima would have been terrible.
Yeah. You and I would have had our scheduled cry right on air.
Yeah. I wish they had done. I was dying for a pot challenge.
Yeah. And I thought, weren't we supposed to get a Rocky Mountain Oysters challenge? I guess that still hasn't happened yet. And we'll talk about the fact that it seems like Telluride is the finals location. We're really not going anywhere exotic in particular. We're staying in state. But that was another thing that they really pimped out during that big supercut of the season that we haven't seen yet. So I feel like there are still a couple of Colorado quote unquote staples that they haven't hit.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think, you know, you guys hit on it yet. Last week, and so I don't want to retread the same territory, but Denver, like, I don't want to. Denver is fun. I've been to a lovely wedding there. I've spent some summers there. Denver is not enough for this, in my opinion.
Denver has Lachlan Patterson, who's appeared like 3 times on the show at this point.
Yeah, he's going back to the same well.
Like one guy.
Yeah, he'll become the next judge at this point by the amount of times that they're using him. I do want to start off as well, sort of segue into the episode proper to bring up something that we didn't really talk about last week. But going into this episode, Joe Stash has had a really particularly interesting trajectory, at least, you know, for the past few episodes. You could argue that he could have gone home during Restaurant Wars, considering he made 3 dishes and none of them succeeded. Tom made it very clear that he wanted him to go home during the sudden death quickfire last time. You could argue he should have gone home during the elimination challenge due to the mac and cheese. So Haley, at this point, and again, he's going to have a big redemption in this episode, but going into this episode, I don't know, was Joe starting to sort of fill that territory for you of, you know, your Emily from last season, or even Rourke's least favorite contestant, she who must not be named, of like, this person keeps skating by even though they cook the quote unquote worst food in every challenge?
Yes-ish and no-ish. I would say yes-ish because obviously, you know, he's had a rough couple weeks. But what I think Joe does better than, you know, the aforementioned gals is that he, every challenge he goes into it, he tries to just fight for it. And he really does try his best. And he tries to do something interesting and inventive and exciting. And sometimes that doesn't work, but sometimes it really does. And it seemed to work this episode.
Rourke, what's your take on Joe coming into this episode? Am I giving him the wrong moniker by equating him to a bottom G.Otis at this point?
So I want to backtrack a little bit to like the trajectory of like a couple people and how I think like there are always these kind of types in reality competition skills shows, like I wouldn't put Survivor in this category. Like I would say, like, it's when you have a genuine specific skill out in the world and you bring it onto a reality show. There's like the Joe Stash, who is sort of like riding a roller coaster where he has had some really high highs and really low lows. And luckily he's sort of, I guess, Haley, I think you said it well, able to sort of fight through the low. And then in my opinion, you have somebody like Adrian, who is just been middling the whole time. And I'm more wondering why, like, she, from an editing perspective, like, she's not winning. Like, we just know nothing about her. In my opinion, I could be crazy, but yeah, I'm like shocked that she is still around. And Tom has sort of called that out before, where he's like, oh, they just hoped someone would be worse.
Yeah. And they've, yeah, they try to reprimand that too. I think they've actually gotten rid of people in early stages in some of the past seasons for being like, we see that you're adamantly trying to play the middle and we want to weed that out. Cause I don't think it's a good strategy, but I don't think they want to instill that strategy because that doesn't necessarily make for good television.
Absolutely. And then I also think that to go back to Restaurant Wars, I fully believe that, the episode before, like Restaurant Wars, obviously they all know what their production schedule is. The challenge before Restaurant Wars is when Claudette and Tanya were in the bottom two and Tanya went home.
Mm-hmm.
They 100% knew that Restaurant Wars was next and Claudette has trouble with teamwork.
Mm.
I really believed they saved her to send her home.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I love tinfoil hat theories on reality television, so I'm willing to at least subscribe to this one, get an e-newsletter about it.
And so that's like, they were like, oh, well, you know, we sort of protected her through that challenge. We got our perfect reason to get rid of her here. Let's just do it, which would cover for Joe Stash's poor cooking in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Adrian a little bit, because this is a really interesting episode for Adrian as well. And I totally agree with you, Rourke, that up to this point, I was definitely thinking less about why is Joe here and more so why is Adrian here? Because Joe has just been, like you said, it's a roller coaster, very up and down. I would actually say that that's sort of like the theme of this season, it seems, at least with people like Chris and Joe and Bruce and even Carrie a little bit at the beginning. It's a lot of people have had really bad moments, but also really good moments. We haven't reached the, you know, your Paul's or even your Kristen's levels of, oh, here's someone who's just really good all the time. And when they're not good, they're just only they're only a little not good and just they don't completely bomb the dish. But Adrian starts off here with a little bit of personal information, which, again, you mentioned, Rourke, we haven't seen too much of aside from her just sort of listing off the restaurants that she's worked on. And it turns out that Adrian she says she's OCD a little bit later, which is why she got so into pastries. But she is a journaler. She has written down, you know, every single thing that the judges have critiqued her on. And she's hoping to sort of use this to build up her own new Top Chef mentality so that she remembers, OK, let me make sure I don't make the same mistakes again. Haley, do you think that's a good idea to sort of chronicle what you did wrong in each and every challenge and hope you can improve upon those mistakes later on?
Yeah, I love that. I think that's an awesome thing to do in a competition like this. It's, you know, it shows that she's really taking the feedback and meditating on it and thinking about it and trying to apply it to her next challenges. And yeah, we haven't seen her be amazing, but she started off the season in the bottom pretty consistently, and she's been middle and closer to the top for the last few weeks. So clearly, you know, that strategy is working. And I think that's something that maybe people in the future should start doing as well, because that's a good way to be like, okay, so, you know, in these types of dishes, I need to do this. And these ones, I need to do this. And that's a really self-aware, interesting thing to do. Rourke, you're the psychology student among us. So what do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's intelligent. It's noble. It's a good way to improve yourself. And I have the utmost respect for somebody that takes the feedback they're getting really seriously. I have a ton of respect for Adrian's skill. I guess I would still just say, though, that like from an editing perspective, that's it's sort of more business than personal. Whereas with Carrie, every single week, we've gotten a sprinkling of something, whether it's in this one about her dad and his struggle with dementia or her personal confidence, you know, like that's a really different learning.
Yeah. Let's talk about that Carrie sprinkle a little bit where, you know, she has this phone call with her dad.
This is going to be my scheduled cry for the day.
Perfect. I'm glad we were able to squeeze that in among all the podcasting hail. Actually, you know, just combine two birds with one stone, which is probably someone else's, the Avian Society's worst nightmare.
Trixie Mattel style?
Yeah, exactly.
Trixie Mattel style. Woo. Really tripped over my words there.
So we get Carrie sort of having this phone conversation with her dad, and you can sort of tell when they're talking that there's something going on behind that. It's not just a normal sort of conversation between a father and daughter. And she reveals that after her parents got divorced, his mental state sort of deteriorated and he has early signs of dementia. And I mean, this is a horrifically tragic story. And you know, my heart goes out to Carrie. It's really interesting that we're finding this out now. I mean, I'm going to assume that there's going to be a family challenge coming up as well, just because that's something that they tend to do every season on Top Chef now. So maybe this will tie in too. But it was really nice to get to know Carrie too, because like you said, Rourke, Carrie has had a really interesting trajectory on her own. And she even vocalizes it later on in this episode about how when she started off, she really didn't feel like she belonged here. But she's gained a lot of confidence in herself as a small town chef compared to the Bruce Kalmans of the world. And it's really nice just to, that's one of the things I really like about this show, is that it is food forward. But it really takes the time to showcase who these contestants are as people. And I feel like, you know, this was a very sad part to learn about Carrie's life, but I was appreciative of for it, at least to know, you know, who Carrie's cooking for and, you know, what she's striving to do and why she wants that win.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I thought, appropriately edited. It was not too big, not too small, and really, really sweet.
Yeah, it's very Goldilocks of you to say that, Rourke. Yeah, save it for Last Chance Kitchen. Let's go from sad to a bit scary. The chefs get driven a different way. They get off the highway and go to Boulder, and not just Boulder, the Stanley Hotel. Now, we alluded to this a bit in the last podcast, Haley. I know Antonio Mazzaro missed out. You know, he's a huge fan of The Shining. You alluded to the fact that you are not necessarily. What's your history with Stephen King in general?
Hard fucking pass. Thank you very much. I told the story, I think it was on the Bachelor podcast, and Rourke, I can't remember if it was during the draft episode we did with you, but I vaguely remember telling it at some point. I don't do scary movies, and part of that reason is The Shining. When I was younger, we went to a cottage with family friends, and 7-year-old Haley watched The Shining with everyone else, and I was emotionally scarred for, I don't know, about the last 20 years, I would say. And part of that was the next day we were watching Twister, and a part in Twister is that at the drive-in theater, The Shining is playing, and I thought there was some sort of demon in the TV that made The Shining come on again, and I had to run out of the room.
Yes,
horrified. Beyond horrified.
So you thought that the movie was now haunting
yes.
you for the rest of your
yeah.
life.
Wouldn't you?
I guess so. That is very coincidental to be watching Twister the next
yeah.
day and The Shining scene comes up. Rourke, do you have such a troubled history with the film or any of Stephen King's work as Haley does?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I saw the new It and the group that I was in. There's a big like jump scare moment. And this guy in our group fully launched out of the movie theater seat. And we basically could not stop laughing for the rest of the film, just remembering his complete fear. And so that sort of lightened the mood. But no, I really like Stephen King. I think he's a great author, and I don't really dabble too far into horror. I like hate paranormal. Like I just don't mm-hmm. want to do like Paranormal Activity, The Conjuring, all that stuff. I can pass on it, but at least his stuff is kind of more creative and interesting. And anyway,
Well, I'm glad you've taken the stand for Stephen King and are not sending him to the proverbial pet cemetery.
Exactly.
What misery that would be. Yeah, so I'm definitely in the Haley boat in terms of scary movies. You know, the people that listen to the movie podcast I do called The Hamster Factor. When I'm not being forced to be shown horror films, I give my distaste in them. I especially work. I would be that guy friend in every scenario with a jump scare. Jump scares, I they're probably the thing I hate most in this world. I just don't understand why you need them in film or in life. It makes absolutely no sense. But I have seen The Shining before. Like, you know, every millennial, I watched The Simpsons parody of it before I actually watched the movie itself. So it was a lot.
I can't watch The Simpsons Halloween episodes because they are too scary for me. Like, I'm not even kidding.
I've never seen The Simpsons.
Real? What? No, the Haley.
Yeah, I
really?
Swear to God. Swear
really?
To God. Do you know? Like, tortured I am still by the one Halloween episode where they went into the cafeteria and then they were being like fed their schoolmates. I still think about that. That's,
yeah, I mean, to be fair, that's a very scary one, to be fair. Like, the idea is very scary, and it's not helped by the fact that at the end of that segment they all get turned inside out by an air and they start dancing skinless to a chorus line. But
yeah, so don't come at me and say, oh, really? Oh, you're afraid of The Simpsons? Yeah, I fucking am. I'm afraid of everything, okay? I am afraid of everything. I only watch comedies. I don't watch dramas. I don't watch horror. The Twins and The Shining still haunt me to this day. And I haven't seen that movie since the original time I saw it. I don't do horror. And this challenge grossed me out, so.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it. Well, first I'll say, have you watched any movies with twins and think that The Shining is still haunting you now?
How dare you?
Well, let's talk about this challenge a bit. So yeah, the challenge is to create a dessert that visualizes your worst nightmare. Now, there's some weirdness around this challenge, and it's not just dealing with the spirits that Padma believes in that exists in the Stanley Hotel that we are going to
again
talk
I
about.
Do not fuck with spirits, so you bring me to a haunted place, I'm out.
I was gonna say, Haley, do you believe in ghosts?
I don't not believe in them. I don't want the ghost to get mad at me saying that. Again, with aliens.
It sounds like there's one behind you right now as you're speaking this.
The aliens, I don't fuck with them. The devil, don't fuck with him either. You know, if they exist, well then, who am I to say that they don't? I don't know. And the best way to get haunted is to say I don't believe in them. So I'm trying not to get haunted here.
What about you, Roy?
I mean, I really don't. I really like data. I really like facts. And like a fact that I always go back to is that areas with really high levels of belief in ghost stories also like has a super high correlation with illiteracy rates. And like, what's like a really good way to tell your city's stories and make them memorable? Add a ghost. And so like, I don't know. I think there's stuff there, but then there are also people that I really trust and are smart, highly educated, scientific people that say that they have had experiences. So I don't know. I don't really think about it that much, but like, I would never like go on a ghost tour or anything, but that's not because I'm afraid. It's because like, I don't want to feed that industry.
Yeah, the only sort of paranormal experience that I had is apparently in my childhood home. My parents seem to think that the ghost of my paternal grandmother is haunting us. There was like my dad had gotten like some joke bottles of Ensure for his like 60th birthday. And apparently they went downstairs one time and like they were half drank and they did some garage repairs and they found a slipper in the wall. So there's been a lot of weird stuff going on. But as you said, Rourke, there might be some correlation there. Before I completely sound the ghost alarm, I'd be intrigued to hear from you guys. If you had to create a dessert around your worst nightmare, would you be able to, or would you go the Bruce route and completely call an audible and say, you know what, I'm just going to come up with something completely different because mine is too metaphoric to try to put on a plate?
Mine would be like, my worst fear is saying the wrong thing to people. So I could just do like cookie cutter sandwiches, you know, with some words written in a speech bubble. Like I could easily do that.
That can't be your worst fear.
I have a lot of fears to pick from.
Yeah, you just talked about your fear of ghosts. I think that could be something you embody on a plate.
Kidnapping, murder. Like, I grew up on murder shows rather than cartoons. Like, for whatever reason, my father thought it was a great idea for us to just watch, like, a lot of American Justice and Cold Case Files. So I definitely thought I was going to get kidnapped as a child. That belief has also, you know, transferred into adulthood, because why wouldn't it? So that's one of my fears. Heights, I'm afraid of. I can't even, like, look out a window without getting weak in the knees. So I could do, like, a really tall dessert, like a croquembouche or something like that.
Wait, on what floor can you not look out the window? Are you saying on the ground floor you can't look out the window?
A ground floor I can handle, but, like, anything above, nauseated, just right off the bat. Even, like, I can't even look down our stairwell without being like, ugh. So that's another one. You know, just people in general are horrifying. Big animals, I can't fight them off, you know.
Oh, big animals could work. You could have made, like, I don't know, elephant steak, or I don't even know if that's a thing, but, like, something out of big animals.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of options for me, you know, unlike Bruce, who seems to be fearless, but.
What about you, Rourke?
Yeah. Okay, so that's the thing. I was going to say that I would say my fears are more about, like, being X alive. So, like, being buried alive, being burned alive, like, all that stuff, like, that would be terrible. And so, like, being buried alive, you could make sort of like a hard chocolate coffin with, like, something in it.
Oh.
You could do a flambé. You could, you know, like, set on, like, a creme brulee on fire. And, like, that's, I guess, my issue with Bruce. There are so many fears to choose from, like
the Yupik seeds.
Like, come up with make something up that's better.
That was to me, it was like part of the Hung Smurf Village school of, like, so bad it's funny choices in quick fire challenges. Because, yeah, like, again, I think Bruce was a little checked out at this point. He's like, I want to use pomegranates. How can I put pomegranates in a dish? Let me come up with this fear of seeds, because I might be painting with a broad brush here. I am 97% sure that nobody has a fear of seeds unless I'm referring to those that don't want to be fathers. Like, that's the only reason.
Oh my God.
There's a specific group of people, and a friend of mine is one of them, not necessarily afraid of seeds, but just, like, really uncomfortable by, like, a lot of little circles together, and, like, looking into a pomegranate could be, like, one of those things, or, like, looking into a beehive, or just, like, a bunch of little dots. I can't remember what it's called, but it exists.
Oh man. Do not give those people Dippin' Dots, because then they will have a full out panic attack.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, wait, Haley, that's a fear of pores. It's trypophobia.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess maybe Bruce could have gone with that instead of seeds, which I loved Padma's reaction, where she gave him the biggest WTF look I've seen in quite some time of Top Chef, of like, really, bitch? You say you're afraid of seeds? What the hell is that? It's interesting, though, because, like, Bruce's nightmare was, what, drowning and falling off a cliff, and open water is my worst nightmare, so I don't necessarily go with him and him saying, like, oh, there was nothing I could do, because I feel like you could do something with water. You know, you could go with, like, a sea creature and, like, I don't know, drown it in a type of sauce or something like that. I think there
poached
was room.
Egg.
Yeah, and there was room to go with. I feel like the other four at least tried to be a little creative with theirs. Bruce just seemed to be, again, in a completely different headspace, and that totally makes sense given everything else that's happening in his life, and also how he said at the very beginning of this episode that his confidence felt very shaken. But he decides to think at that moment, you know what would be great? Ah, fear of seeds. That will certainly get me the win on this quickfire.
Yeah, I just don't even understand the thought process is a mystery to me.
I have no idea. I talked to Bruce, I think, about it a little bit in my interview with him, but he did not allude to much, which seems like he is ready to bury that seed fear and let it hopefully not grow over time.
Ready to bury that seed fear. Whatever you just said.
Yes. No, you really nailed that joke, Haley.
Yes, that is the opposite of my worst nightmare. That is my best dream. A horrible pun. I love it. Let's talk a little bit about the other choices that some of these other chefs make, because, again, I do feel like they were at least ambitious in what they were going for. But Haley, between Adrian's fear of blood, stepping in the woods and blood comes out,
Disgusting.
Joe Stash's fear of cracking into a chicken egg and there
extra
being
extra disgusting
an embryo in there. Carrie, this actually falls right into your wheelhouse, Haley. The ballroom scene from The Shining would probably be
disgusting.
And Chris is pulling 127 hours, falling off a cliff.
And disgusting. All of these, looking at them, made me want to puke and die. So if that was what they were going for, excellent job. The only one looking at it I would have eaten was Carrie's tahini panna cotta because it was unfinished and less disgusting than the other
ones. Because there was nothing on it. There was two pieces of panna cotta and a smear of raspberry.
Want me to sit here and eat a dish that a guy just told me reminded him of an egg embryo? I want to puke talking about it. Never mind if I had to look at it. There's just no way I would have put it in my mouth.
But it's not that.
I know, but it's just, I don't have the ability to separate that idea and what's in front of me.
What about you, Rick? Are you able to sort of separate the fact away from fiction, as you've alluded to before, and be able to eat these dishes? And if so, which one stood out to you?
So, I mean, I have celiac, so I can't have gluten. So I would be a terrible Top Chef judge. It's just something that's never going to happen for me. Even though I think Zooey Deschanel did a gluten-free challenge on MasterChef once, or Top Chef Masters. Sorry.
I think late Lea Michele did a gluten-free challenge as well.
Oh, nice.
When she was on the New Orleans season.
Gluten-free and vegetarian, I think she had.
Well, there we go. That's my only window. Just get as famous as them and then demand stuff. But no, I would have, if I could eat it, I would have been into Chris's. Like, that chocolate cake looked so good. I would have been totally into that.
Yeah, and there, we find out some really fun stuff about these chefs as well, much as hopefully the audience found out a little bit about us and our fears. I love Carrie talking about how descriptive her dreams are. For instance, the night
really
before,
funny.
She dreamed of a tater tot made with pine nuts and stuffed with jam. Haley, would you have rather had that or her unfinished ode to the Shining ballroom?
I would have done both. Yeah, the tater tot I could have done easily. And hers, because it was unfinished.
Yeah, if only she had grabbed it out of her dream and put it on the plate. Maybe she would have been able to actually give her a complete dish.
Exactly.
It could have been like a pinole tot, you know, like those pine nut cookies.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be really good with some jam. I'm down.
I also like Joe Stash saying he doesn't remember a lot of dreams. And you're like, I know that we haven't had a pot challenge, as you alluded to, Rourke, but I feel like we've gotten, you know, bits and pieces of Joe Stash's hipster-esque nature. But here, They really no subtext whatsoever. He just says, yeah, I don't remember a lot of my dreams because I smoke a lot of weed, which I did not ever think we'd get on Top Chef. Someone just actually outright admitting that they smoke a lot of weed. But here we are in the year 2018. It's a new way of Top Chef. And I guess the location calls upon it.
Yeah. And I mean, he's from San Francisco. He's in a state where it's legal. He's from a state where it's legal. No felonies here.
Well, can I also, in this segment, put forward a request into the universe to get Chris Scott onto any sort of baking show? Because I want to see Mr. Creme Brulee, Mr. Reverend Sweet, Mr. Creamy Bound Brother, or Dr. Chocolate. Dr.
That
Chocolate is by far the best one.
I'd watch that movie.
Especially if Chris was in it, just because, again, his voice is so sultry and so soothing. But I know that he said that baking isn't really his thing, but he has a couple of tricks that he's going to pull out, this challenge included. But I don't know, I feel like it's very rare that we see baking intersect with Top Chef, and I would love to see Chris at least compete on another one of these cooking shows, even if it is in baking, where he can't make marzipan men every episode. I don't know, Haley, you watch a lot of these baking shows. Do you feel like Chris would fit in there?
No, those people are very, very peppy often. I feel like Chris would be like, man, all these people suck. Like, they're so loud. Like, I'm just chill, hanging out. And everyone's like, I'm putting as much sugar on these things, and I'm doing this and this. And Chris would be like, yeah, I'm just going to do this and then this, and it's going to be cool, and we're fine. I love Chris and would watch that. So give that to me. One thing we did not watch, though, folks, is another judge in this challenge.
Let's talk about this, because we have had the pleasure of, you know, the Top Chef fandom putting on their chef detective hats and really trying to scope things out, because I think the three of us were talking before this podcast, or I know there were some people in the RHAP patron group talking about how things just seemed a little off. And again, it wasn't the spooky imagery or voiceovers that were going on. Rourke, I think, what did you say about the ADR in your notes?
Oh, I said this ADR is insane. Like, the levels were bad. The like she just sounded so different. It's like, I know what Padma would sound like if she read an audiobook.
Yeah, or if she messed up the audiobook in several places and had to go back and edit several random words in there. But Haley, yeah. I know that you have a submitted theory that might be able to explain exactly what might have been going on with this wonky style of editing for this challenge.
Yeah, so I definitely noticed the awkwardness, and I thought, oh, maybe they cut someone out. And then my friend Phil, he tweeted me saying he thought it was Johnny Uzini, known from the single episode of Great American Bake Off, ended abruptly due to his sexual harassment claims. And then he was also a host or a judge on Top Chef Desserts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I thought that made a lot of sense, especially because this was a dessert quickfire in Top Chef when he's kind of had some experience in the Top Chef universe before. And then, Mike, you said that you had some tea that matched up with Phil's theory. So you go ahead now.
Yeah, so there was a press release that was sent out before the season listing out, you know, all of the guest judges that would be on this season. And they seemed to go in chronological order of when they appeared. Johnny Uzini was not only on that list, but he was sandwiched between Adam Perry Lang, who was the guest judge on last episode's Elimination Challenge, and Wiley Dufresne, who seems to be the guest judge on next episode's challenge. So if they went in chronological order, for all intents and purposes, you would imagine that he was in there. There was also, outside of the editing, you know, it seemed like they were preparing three plates, and you'd imagine that two of them were for the judges and one of them was for the aforementioned food porn camera. And so there was like, who is this ghost plate for? And it appears that it is the ghost of Johnny Uzini, the show, obviously.
And his career.
Exactly. Rest in peace, or not in peace, I suppose, because that's a horrible thing that he did. But yeah, that sort of leads to the odd stuff that was going on in the course of this challenge. Though I guess they could sort of blame it on all the other occult stuff going on. But yeah, that's a bit of an explanation for the listeners as to why that segment might have seemed weirder than usual. But going into the dishes themselves, you know, I like Rourke. I really enjoyed Chris's push from 12,000 feet. I like the little titles that they gave to them as well. I don't know if they gave the titles, but I mean, Seeds of Dread from Bruce, even though it's a stupid concept, it's a really funny name. I really like Chris's little marzipan man, like very Mr. Bill-esque, and in a like, this is not supposed to be funny, but it totally is kind of way. Joe's concept sounds disgusting and horrifying, but I kind of liked what he did with it. Like the egg yolk ice cream with the pistachio crumble on it, and the when he made the meringue. I mean, this will be an episode of people trying to do things for the first time. This is one example where Joe had never made a meringue before, but was actually able to do so successfully. And Adrienne, I mean, I have to give her credit for calling it Into the Woods, because that's my favorite musical of all time. But I really like the varying, you know, the chocolate branches with the red going on. It's a weird image, stepping into the woods and having blood seep out from under it. But I think she did a pretty good job overall. Haley, I know you had some disgust towards all of these concepts, but did any dishes stick out to you in particular?
I loved some of the techniques Adrienne was using, and she was doing some really cool stuff. One of them was the chocolate branches in the water. I love that. I don't know. Visually, they looked cool, and that's why they made me nauseated, was because they looked so cool and real.
So they did their job correctly, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's interesting that like Padma seemed to be, and Rourke, you can disagree with me, or it feels like she wanted that. Right. She wanted to go for that. It brings to mind like the Charlize Theron challenge from season 9, where it was like, oh, give me something horrific for the whatever the Snow White movie that she was in. And that's where like someone made a blood splatter on the plate. I think Grayson made like this black chicken leg. So it seemed like Padma in this case, she was like, Joe, I love the taste, but it wasn't gory enough. So it's kind of weird that it went to Chris, who, again, did more of a cartoony type of dish, but I guess taste combined with the mere thought gave him the win here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these judges want them to lean into the challenge. And I know that the example you just gave is a good one. And I also think about the that big like meat hall.
Oh,
dinner.
Yeah, beefsteak. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 13.
Yeah. And they were like, we want to eat with our hands. We want like a giant tomahawk. And like all of this is too dainty. And so I think when the challenges are sort of maybe I don't want to say theme. I guess this is a theme, like themed or kind of silly. Like, just go for it.
Well, speaking of theming, let's talk about this elimination challenge, too, because we saw this last season. I don't believe we did it. We saw it the season before, but it looks like it might start becoming a tradition here. This is your last challenge before you move on to Telluride and the final. So I want you to cook a dish that represents your culinary journey through Colorado. Haley, I know you said at the top of this podcast that you felt like this might have been a little bit too loosey-goosey of a theme. Do you have any specific thoughts towards this challenge in general?
I don't know why this challenge weirds me out or just feels like a little disconnected, but it's just kind of like high school-y to me. It's like, here's your food, make a food yearbook about your time on Top Chef. And something about that just, I don't know. I don't even know why it feels a little off to me. Maybe because we've already had a challenge this season where, you know, people went back into their history and made a dish that meant a lot to them. And that was way more meaningful to me than this. And it seemed like, you know, a few people were kind of lost at the concept and didn't really. I just, for a challenge that's the last one before you go to the finals, like, I just wanted something tighter or more extravagant or more exciting, where it's just like, you know, cook us something that represents your time here. Like, that could be anything and you could make a reason why. So it was just a little too wide for me, I think, maybe.
I personally don't mind these, like, bigger challenges. Vaguer, I guess.
I don't either. And maybe it's just because I like to sort of wax nostalgic about sort of where we were 9 episodes ago. And I think it also depends on the strategies that are employed. You know, I did sort of like Joe, Adrian, and Carrie all sort of saying, okay, I'm going to use the word journey specifically and really represent.
Maybe it reminds me too much of The Bachelor, and that's why. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have 2 hours to cook.
With roses.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, they did that last time. They had the edible flowers last challenge, Haley.
True, so true.
It's all themed. Yeah. I mean, I can understand why it could come across as a little hokey. And as we're going to talk about, I think some people, I wouldn't say misinterpret the theme, but I think use the theme in a way that is probably not best utilized. But I do think it's interesting that 3 out of the 5 of them decide to go with, hey, these are some things that I did not so well. I'm going to try to use this as an opportunity to redeem myself. Rourke, I know you said you like these types of challenges. Do you feel like that's the way to approach these types of challenges, by saying, let me try to undo previous mistakes?
I think it's one option. And I think it's a completely valid option. I think what's funny is that, I guess the way I would have thought of it, and I was sort of almost in coming to this conclusion, thinking about how I think Bruce should have thought of it. And to me, I would have tried to look at, like, what was my defining sort of shift point with the judges? And his, in my opinion, his shift point was when Tom said, like, this is you. And I think that's when it was maybe the snow camping challenge, when he used the mandolin to shape the pasta. And he should have just done, like, maybe one pasta with 3 different sauces, or 3 different a pasta flight. Like, he just should have said, like, things changed for me when we both embraced who I was. This is full hog Bruce. And, like, he just that to me was so clear. I, like, couldn't figure out why he couldn't figure it out. I was like, I know you so well.
Have you met Bruce? I know you're in the LA area too.
I have not met Bruce.
Yeah, I know you have met several chef testants, though, right? Have you, or is it just Tylor? I know we've been talking about that.
Oh, yeah. I sat across from Tylor, boring. He was not boring. He was lovely. At a dinner recently. But I think I saw Antonia at, she and I were getting smoothies at the same place one morning before work, and I was too nervous to say anything.
I like how your initial part of the sentence seemed to sound like, oh yes, Antonia and I got smoothies together. We do it like every Thursday morning. We just sort of chit-chat about what's going on.
Yeah, no, that's the dream. But no, I think correcting a past mistake is perfectly fine. I don't know, though, I don't know that a mistake encapsulates a journey, but who am I to tell them what to do, even though that's just what I did.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, though, is, you know, I totally can see where you're coming from in talking to Bruce and saying, hey, this is really your turnaround moment. I say you really acknowledge it. But I mean, he's sort of haunted. He has his own spirits, the pasta spirits in his head. And we get this montage as well of, hey, here are all the pastas I prepared, to the point of where Padma last episode was saying, you guys are killing me with all this pasta and polenta. Hilly, do you think those comments ruminating in his head steered him away from making pasta? And therefore, do you think that also might have helped spell his doom?
Absolutely. And probably definitely.
Lots of adverbs there.
Yeah, he had the pasta yips.
Well, probably something that didn't help, even if Bruce was sort of on thin ice with the pasta ideas. The chefs come back to the kitchen and they're met with Tom. Tom's going to have a nice fireside chat by the burners with these chefs where he sort of lectures them, sort of encourages them, but mostly threatens them, saying, hey, look, I've seen better food in LCK this season. If you don't do well here, I might just bring two people back. Rourke, one, do you think this threat held any water, unlike Bruce when he's drowning, which is his worst nightmare? And two, do you feel like it needed to happen, considering the lashing that he had given them last episode?
Yeah, I don't really know. Like, that to me read as more of a promo for Last Chance Kitchen than like a motivational speech, where it's like, tune in later for the best cooking we've seen all season. And like okay. I just think that stuff like that is so, I mean, I played like competitive sports through high school and, you know, like, I'm not going to claim that that's a high level, but like sports psychology, like anytime you're in a competition setting, like sports psychology, that like getting out of your head is probably the most important thing. And so maybe the idea of two people coming back doesn't exactly scare them, but the fact that somebody is disappointed in you can certainly make you perform worse. I don't see that type of feedback making anybody better, frankly.
Yeah, Haley, what's your take on Tom's talk here?
He's really trying to be inspirational this season, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He had some words of wisdom, you know, last season around this time when he was talking to Sheldon about like what cooking represents and how Sheldon represents cooking. So maybe he's trying to get his own brand out there.
Maybe I'm like last week with the, I'm disappointed in you and this and that, and you need to do this and that. And I don't know. Might be a trend with Tom.
When he told Sheldon that one day Sheldon would like take his place among the chefs, we wept. I just openly wept. That was so lovely.
Was that an unscheduled cry then? Or is that something?
It took me by surprise.
Yes. I'd say Fatima's Instagram probably usurped that moment, which is what you would usually put on it for that scheduled cry, I'm assuming.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it was a weird situation. And I honestly don't know if that held water. I don't know if Tom would have actually done it if they had put out lackluster food. But I guess, again, as you said at the very beginning of this podcast, Rourke, we can't taste the food, but I guess it was that bad last time, because we have never seen this before of Tom saying like, hey, everybody, don't fuck it up, like, or I'm going to do something really bad. Just you wait, especially this late in the competition. It's really kind of weird to see, but they decide to sally forth. I know Antonio Mazzaro told me to let this go, but I will not let this go. Joe Stash says, I'm going to make lamb because I really screwed up the lamb last time. But it wasn't you, Joe Stash, who screwed up the lamb. It was freaking two. Two screwed up the lamb, and I'm never going to let anyone forget it. Joe Stash had no reason to do that, but you know what? He's trying to, I guess, make improvements on the mistakes that he was involved with. Carrie is going to embrace the dishes that she did well in. Adrian says, you know what? I've only succeeded on doing fish once on Top Chef, but I make fish all the time, and I'm going to go with, you know, a fish that I'm really comfortable with. Her journey is more so about realizing, you know, I should not just be replicating recipes that I've seen in restaurants that I've worked in. I should be cooking my own food. Chris has a really interesting take on what he should be doing. We spoke about Bruce, but Chris says, you know what I really liked about Top Chef was the people. I'm going to use this dish as a dedication to all the people that I cooked with. Haley, when I was watching this at the time, I just was saying no, 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 no consistently at my computer screen, because this is, Padma says it at the very end, you know, it's this is your journey. The challenge is about your journey. And Chris is essentially saying, my journey is everyone else. Like, it says nothing personal really towards him as a chef.
Yeah, this was like the encapsulation of that, oh no, what is you doing, baby meme.
Oh my God.
It was just kind of like, Chris, no, like, no, don't make ravioli. You don't know how to make ravioli. Stop that. Like, dude, stop that. Make that fried chicken again.
Yeah, it is really strange the choices that Chris makes here. As you mentioned, Haley, he decides, I haven't made ravioli before, but it's something that I really want to try to explore. Again, is an ode to the other chefs that have sort of been competing alongside him. I mean, Rourke, am I overblowing this? Was this not as bad of a decision on Chris's part considering he stayed? Or what do you think the thinking is behind this strategy in general?
So I think with a minor pivot, this becomes okay in my mind. If, let's say, like, I cook really like rustic, simple food and I'm on a season with Richard Blaise and he teaches me to use liquid nitrogen. And so then I say, like, part of this journey is the ability to layer skills onto my skill set. So then I like use liquid nitrogen in a me way, you know, like that I think is a way where it really works. But he really did just sort of try to make what they make, which is a different thing. Am I saying that clearly?
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. Okay. He was trying to essentially, you know, build a Frankenstein combining different parts from what the chefs have been cooking. And they're going to talk about this later at Judge's Table, but he didn't really need to do all of that. It came off as a little disparate, almost like what Brother did is doing in Last Chance Kitchen, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You know, there is this whole, I feel like if there's a theme this season, it's about the beauty and the simplicity when it comes to some of these dishes. And when you overly complicate things, it sort of mulls the palate just a tiny bit. Let's get to the actual dishes themselves. First, we should say that they are sending them off in style in Denver by having them dine at the governor's mansion. I really love the tie-in that apparently John Hickenlooper, who was the governor, was like started off as a restaurateur and a bar owner who became a politician. That sounds like a crazy story on its own. What's even crazier is probably the kitchen that they have to cook in, even smaller than the one they had to cook in the Top Chef house kitchen when Brooke was there. It seems like especially the bigger guys are having some problems with trying to navigate around that very narrow kitchen, Haley.
Yeah, this made me uncomfy and a little claustrophobic. So also, for those keeping track at home, you can add claustrophobia to my fears, too.
I can't imagine how you would make a dish out of that.
I don't know either. I'm sure someone can figure it out.
Just cram a bunch of things really close together.
Yeah.
You could like overstuff a pasta shell. Like,
yeah, that's true.
It was like dying to get out.
Yeah, that's a very smart idea. I really like that. I figured since we only have five dishes, let's just give our brief thoughts on each one of these here. Let's talk about the winning dish first. Joe Stash, this lamb agnolotti with beets, hazelnuts, and cacio pecora. Cheese. Lots of use of the cheese from all the way back in the second episode, but I guess it makes sense. If cheese was like the main ingredient of one challenge, it would make sense to use that to encapsulate your journey. Rourke, did this feel like the winning dish to you when you initially saw it?
Nope. I literally, so as I watched it, I like ranked them based on not based on my own opinions, but based on like the praise I was hearing. And I had Carrie as number one.
Interesting. Yeah. I had, maybe this is me reading the edit too much. I had Adrian as number one personally, but now looking back, we'll definitely talk about the dishes, but I can understand why you would have Carrie as number one. But suffice it to say, I also didn't know that Joe's dish would be the best one. I think it was very praised and I think it looked very, very good. And I think Graham really vocalized it well, that it showed a lot of restraint, which, as we go back to consistently with that Keegan remark towards him a while ago about how you have a bag full of tools that are too heavy to lift, you need to use them sparingly. That's a problem he's had throughout the entire competition. So I guess from that improvement perspective, that might have given him the win. I don't know. Haley, what did you feel about the dish?
I think it sounds delicious, but I also thought it was going to be Adrian who won. It sounded like she got a lot of praise for what she did, the creativity aspects. But maybe it's because both Carrie and Adrian did some cauliflower pureeing or roasted cauliflower that the judges were like, you know what? We're not giving a win for everyone using a damn cauliflower puree. Because there was three dishes out of five had a cauliflower component. I didn't realize that was such a popular aspect of food in Colorado.
Well, Tom said that cauliflower was on the rise in the very last episode. Should they not listen to some of his words and ignore some of the others?
Great point, Mike. I don't know,
but maybe all the cauliflower.
I love cauliflower.
Yeah, so do I. Maybe all the cauliflower just canceled each other out. But that being said, I still think Joe's dish looked really good. It seems like he might have a little bit of a bounce back here. I don't know, Rourke, reading the edit, what do you think the chances are? Joe Stash has now run three elimination challenges, most out of anybody who's left. What do you think the chances are now of Joe sort of taking a Bruce-like route for the past several episodes of, okay, I had my bounce moment, now I'm ready to sort of cruise to a hopeful win?
Are you asking me if I like think he's going to?
Yeah, basically. in a matter of words.
Oh God, I really don't want that.
Are you not a fan of the Joe Stash?
I don't know. I guess not. I guess that's what's coming out here. I guess that's what's slowly being revealed. I don't know. I just feel like, also just because I guess I feel like he has been saved for people I've liked better to be sacrificed. And so and Flam.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like I said, I have my tinfoil hat theory about Claudette, and like, I think he could have gone home there. And I don't know. Like, I remember reading a long time ago an article by Anthony Bourdain who said that from the episodes that he has been a guest judge on, the person who made the worst dish that day goes home, and that like producers were probably like wringing their hands and pulling their hair out when people like Trey went home and Fabio and stuff like that. But like, I don't know if that's still the case anymore, but I just wish some past performance like has to be weighed in. I don't know. I just like, I feel so meh about him. I'm so sort of like Bob. I'm so not drawn to his like overall affect. I'm just like not drawn to him as a person. And that doesn't mean he doesn't deserve to win. Like, I just don't think he and I would, you know, like have a lot to hang out about.
You and him, well, I mean, I don't know. You're probably a bigger basketball fan than Joe is, but that's probably not saying much.
Yes, true.
But Haley, what are your thoughts about this Joe Stash quote unquote winner? Is that, I mean, do you think that he's on a good path now to do well in the rest of the competition?
I don't know if he even has a winner at it. I think he's just somebody that the producers thinks the audience wants to see because he's young and he has a weird mustache and he does crazy things with food. I feel like pretty much everyone here has a reason to win, except maybe Adrian. Like, I can give a pretty good story for Chris and Carrie and Joe, and that's it, right? That's everyone else who's left.
And Last Chance Kitchen returnee.
Yeah, I feel like all of them at the end, if they win, I could be like, oh, I could see their win because of this, this, and this. You know, it's so I could easily make an argument for why Carrie's winning. Like, she has just as good of a story. She has more wins. She's cooked more interesting, better food consistently. She's had these little moments of personality where we see who she is.
I definitely agree with that. And I don't want to get too much into the weeds with the winner edit talk.
Or the weed, like Joe likes to.
Yeah, see, Joe Stash would love to get in the weed, but unfortunately, he'll have to do so after the competition. But I just thought it was interesting that he seemed to really have the edit, which I thought Adrian was going to have this episode of, hey, I really haven't won anything in a while. I've been cruising along the bottom. Now's my chance to shine. And he ends up getting a win here. Again, it seems like he has... I think Carrie has more wins overall, but he has the most elimination challenge wins. So, I mean, it'll be something interesting to track over the next few episodes. But let's talk about Adrian here. Adrian said she's cooking her own food. She finally realizes who she wants to be as a chef, and she makes roasted monkfish with a venison jus. Weird pairing, but it really pays off. I like Tommy.
Sign me up for that.
Yeah, and I love Tommy Lee, not to be confused with the rock and roll star, saying that he appreciates the capriciousness of the flavors. I never thought in my life, Rourke, that I'd hear a dish be described as capricious.
I don't know that he's using that word correctly.
Oh, I'm sure he's not, but I just think it's really funny.
Yeah.
He just sort of walked in with like his word of the day calendar of like, all right, this is the I'm on Top Chef. Here you go, Tommy boy. It's the big leagues. You got to do something big.
I mean, I guess it means like unpredictable. So like, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, I totally agree with you. It definitely is like, I must use this in a sentence today.
My friends bet me $100 that I couldn't use the word capriciousness when I was judging this Top Chef yeah. challenge, but I showed them. Haley, what did you think about it? I know that you and I both agreed that we thought Adrienne was going to win here. What did you enjoy about her dish in particular?
I love fish, so that's cool. With a venison jus, like that sounds very interesting. Green peppercorn jam, I'm super in.
That's your jam.
Super in on that. Great. And cauliflower puree. I love cauliflower. So like all of this sounds great. It all sounds great together. This is probably what I would order if I had all of them in front of me.
Rourke, what did you feel about Adrienne's dish? Capriciousness aside.
Yeah. No, it sounded excellent to me. I love a hearty fish dish. I had a big fish last night for dinner. Yeah, I'll second everything Haley just said.
Well, let's move on to the person that Rourke thought might pull out the W in the end here. Carrie goes for the Colorado girl goes for the Colorado elk with her own roasted cauliflower, shishito peppers, a blueberry poblano sauce, and a shepherd's halo cheese. She gets everything on the plate, so that's an improvement above the quick fire. Rourke, what was it about Carrie's dish that you felt really stood out above the rest?
For me, it was about what Padma said about it, where she said that this was like sort of the most, I'm going to miff her exact words.
It's okay. But we'll edit you in later to cover it up like Padma in the actual show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. She said like, this was the like most like complete seasoned flavored bite she's like had all season or something like that. And I was like, oh, well, can't beat that. Evidently you can. And I love shishito peppers, poblano blueberry sauce, like that sort of spicy sweet sounds so good. It just sounded like a really solid combo. And I think elk is a delicious, underutilized red meat.
Yeah, I think Padma said that it's the most intensely flavored and delicious plate she's had so far. So she's trying to go for her own sort of synonyms there to show up Tommy Lee. Haley, what did you think about Carrie's elk?
Maybe I'm making this up in my head, but did she plate it like her Hasselbeck potato?
Oh, your memory is way better than mine.
Like she almost like layered things in between it. I could have just made this up in my brain, because it seemed like Carrie did a good job at taking a lot of elements from other challenges and putting them together. Like the elk from the snow challenge, it seemed like she used that. The way she plated it reminded me of her Hasselhoff back potato. She used shepherd's halo cheese, which we saw in the cheese challenge. So it seemed like she kind of pulled a lot of stuff together. And I'm with Rourke. The blueberry poblano sauce sounds like heaven in a sauce.
That they should bottle that and give. That'll be the catchphrase for the blueberry poblano sauce. Heaven in a sauce. Well, yeah. Let's move on. If we have heaven in a sauce, we might have hell on a plate here. If the judges' comments are to be taken into consideration with what Bruce put out, his roast duck with toasted barley and corn topped with the salsify. It seemed like basically in a gist, the dish was overseasoned and the barley was undercooked. Bruce have very clearly had some time issues making his barley. Again, his head might have been in a different place, so he wasn't really thinking about it. But it seemed like if, you know, as Rourke was talking about before, this was deemed the worst dish out of the five. Haley, looking at it, do you agree?
He has me sold with duck. Where he loses me is the toasted barley. That just doesn't sound like it's going to work. Like I feel like if you toast barley, it's going to just kind of not be as crunchy as you want. It's just going to be kind of like weird.
Well, he made it like a risotto, so I don't know if he was going for crunchy to begin with.
Yeah, no out on that. I don't know. It just seems a little, it seemed off, and it seemed like not Bruce.
Mm-hmm. Rourke, you have watched Top Chef, as you mentioned, since the beginning. Why do people keep trying to break this risotto curse? When I know, again, superstitions, but I feel like there are facts built into these superstitions, and it feels like every time we see someone say, I know they making risotto isn't a good idea, but this time, this is going to be the time where that curse is broken.
There just must be something about like the both the time and the facility and sort of your divided attention that just makes risotto a really difficult dish to do well. And also, I'm sorry, pasta to risotto, stop it. Like, it, if you're not going to do pasta, that doesn't count. Those are always on the same part of the menu. No.
Yeah. I think it's all sort of part of that, like, grainy, carby stuff that, you know, Bruce wasn't exactly stepping out of his zone there, even though the judges do say this is, quote, not the Bruce we know. I mean, even just looking
at it, tastes bad.
But looking at the plate, like, I don't even feel like it's plated that great either. It really does look like it was just sort of thrown on there. It doesn't really look appealing to me. Compare that to, as we just talked about, Carrie's plating, which is so intriguing and so decadent, or even what, you know, Adrian and Joe were putting out. It feels like it was really lacking in something.
So something I really would like to, I mean, if they're still listening, if Brooke or Jim's or anyone else would like to fill me in on this, I would be really interested to have this information. I probably should have texted you guys before you did those interviews. Is what is the timeline on these interviews that they do? Because my understanding with the Real Housewives is that they film the entire season and then they get a little bit of time off and then they come back and do all of those interviews.
Mm.
And is Top Chef the same? Because obviously Bachelor and Survivor are like literally in the moment, except for if they need something, like if they need you to redo something. And so like, I'm sort of wondering if they were like showing Bruce clips and he is giving these interviews where he's like, oh, like I was just so like, I'm so uninspired. I'm so down, you know, like, is he reliving that? Is he sad in the, like, I'm just trying to figure out where I would love to know where his head was at more in that moment.
I feel like this is have a conversation Mike and the Drag Race crew have on that podcast all the time. And one of the things we learned recently is in Drag Race, at least, confessionals are all done like right as the filming, but they have to wear the same outfit. And so, you know, that's something I kind of look for in all these shows. But I feel like a lot of their hair is pretty much the same too. So I wouldn't doubt if Top Chef was filmed all in one day, like afterwards. But yeah, Jim's or Brooke, can you get at us and let us know? Because that's something I've never really vocalized, I guess, about wondering about.
Yeah, I wonder if I might put myself in the camp about, and again, those that are actually on the show may clarify. I feel like, I know on like Survivor, sometimes you guys get like a day to do interviews. I wonder if that's the case here as well, where like after every round, they'll bring everyone in. They still have them. I mean, that's what LCK is for. Everyone's still sort of secluded and they're all sort of gathered under the eye of production. They can say, okay, come on in, do your talking heads. And maybe that's one reason, if you're going back to your question, Rourke, as to why, where was Bruce coming from with some of the comments he was making in confessionals, I might attribute it to him just sort of failing and getting eliminated and him now sort of having to ruminate on his failures immediately.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. He seemed so down. That like, that's why, like, he just seemed so down the entire episode. Like every interview he gave, he was like, his affect was just awful. Like, and I don't mean like, you know, repugnant to the viewer, but just like, he just seemed so sad.
Yeah. And it's sad because, again, to quote the judges, that's not the Bruce we know. I love smiley Bruce, wise ass Bruce. You know, when Bruce was on top, he was very happy and very excitable. And it just seems like, again, because of maybe external factors or maybe just because he felt like he wasn't good anymore, he just didn't seem like his heart was really in it. And so that not only led to the dishes that he put on the plate that were a little lackluster this episode, but the fact that in his confessionals, he sort of is acting that demure. We still have one more dish to talk about here. Chris ends things on an interesting note with his lamb ravioli with crispy skin trout and a roasted cauliflower puree. This is going to end up on the bottom as well. Haley, what were your thoughts on Chris's dish here?
I mean, it sounds very good and I would eat it, but the way it was being edited, it was kind of like obvious that this was not going to be working out for Chris.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Rourke?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it is reminiscent to me of the snow challenge where he was like, oh, it's not enough to do chili, I have to do steak.
Yeah, it's and that's how Two fell too. It's because he's like, oh, I have to do something three ways. And Padma has this really great quote later on that I was alluding to earlier, where she says, "We do want you guys to push yourselves and be inventive and be creative, but we still always want you to be true to yourselves and to your own styles of cooking." And I do feel like that's sort of the pit that Bruce and Chris got pushed off of and fell into as their proverbial Top Chef hikers. Is that, you know, they decided to think sort of outside of themselves, ironically enough, when being asked to cover their own journeys, is that as a result they weren't really putting their food on there. I know that Chris also comes from a very different perspective in that he doesn't want to necessarily be pigeonholed into the "I'm only a soul food chef" type of person. He mentions this episode about how he worked in high dining for 20 years and he wants to show that he can have that decadence as well, but it just didn't really feel in line. For what it's worth, for his first time making ravioli, apparently the pasta was good, but the filling was off. There was no binder. It looked like he just sort of ground up lamb and put it in there without putting anything else in there. But I do love, there's a little editing moment, and we saw this as well in Restaurant Wars. I sort of feel like Joe Stash is sort of like the James Miller of Survivor Palau of the season of Top Chef, where whenever he says something's going to happen, the opposite is true. Like here when he's like, "Hey, you know what, Chris, you didn't do a good job, but you know what, that filling is going to be your saving grace." When you would argue, it almost sent him home.
Yeah, no, that was when he said that, I was like, "Ooh, wow, that you read that wrong."
Yeah, so I'll be intrigued to see. Hopefully we see more of that as sort of a recurring motif coming up in the next few episodes. But you know who will not be in the next few episodes? Poor Bruce gets eliminated here. Haley, eulogize Bruce for me here in his final moments on Top Chef. He came in as, I would probably argue, and he agrees with me in his interview, he might be the biggest name to ever be a chef testing, who obviously was not on something like Top Chef Masters, where that's the goal. So he walked in definitely with a certain amount of expectations. How do you think that tied into his story overall?
It was a really, almost very unique story, because all the judges knew him and were very open about saying, like, "Oh, Bruce, this isn't your food. I know your food. This isn't you. This isn't what you're doing." And then so it kind of gave him the opportunity to course correct. But then he, like, got off that course. And it was really interesting seeing the storyline with his son being born during filming. And Bruce was just an interesting character, and he seemed like a good guy who everyone more or less liked.
Mm-hmm. Rourke, you have any comments of Bruce to send him off?
You know, I think that he is somebody who is obviously successful now and is going to continue to be super successful. I have absolutely, like, I do not think ability on Top Chef or winning Top Chef is a determinant of success. And so I think he was a fun personality. I hope that his appearance brings people into his restaurants, because for the majority of it, the food looked excellent that he was producing, and he just seems like a lovely guy, and I hope he's enjoying his new son.
Yeah, I think I could understand the controversy behind Bruce sort of coming in, and especially him staying. I do want to bring up a question in a little bit, because I know Sarah Madrista had sort of been talking about this in the comments the past few times about, you know, do they feel like the judging was kind of done with Bruce on a curve? You know, because they knew who Bruce was he able to benefit from that, especially in those first few rounds when he wasn't doing so well? But it's so interesting to see someone who's such an accomplished chef in the real world come in and admittedly struggle starting off with Top Chef. It really just is indicative of how these shows can really be representative of general skills it takes to be a chef. But sometimes great chefs are not great Top Chef contestants. It tests certain skills that might not be necessarily inherent within typical restaurant chefs. We even saw this with Tanya. "Hey, I don't use, you know, thermometers to get an exact number out of them. I cook everything by touch." But as a result, that she sort of fell on her sword or her meat thermometer because of that. So watching Bruce's trajectory was really interesting. Him really not doing well to the point of where Two had to help him with prep. I mean, who knows, in a world where Bruce was not able to get his gnocchi made in time during that first challenge, who knows what could have happened? But I thought his rallying point was really interesting when he has his own sort of epiphany moment where he says, "Oh, I need to be cooking my own food." To have such a veteran chef realize that, I feel like, as Haley was talking about, is very new to this type of contestant that we usually see on Top Chef. But I do think, as I've alluded to countless times in this podcast, that I think everything just sort of caught up to him between the longing for his son, which is a momentous event. And I loved how we got to see that unfold as well and see the genuine excitement and fear and trepidation and elation on his face when he found that out, combined with the fact that these past few times he just sort of felt like maybe I'm not great at this competition. You know, I put a lot of pressure on myself as one of the bigger names coming in here. A lot of people are going to be expecting me to do well, and I'm really not. I can only imagine what that pressure is like, certainly more than what they get in a pressure cooker. So we'll send Bruce off here. Before we do, I do want to sort of go back to that point I referenced at the very beginning of my tangent here. Rourke, how do you respond to the possible idea? Do you feel like, as you mentioned, the judges all knew Bruce? Do you feel like, looking back on everything, that he might have been positively affected by the fact that they knew him in those first few rounds? They knew what he was capable of?
Yeah, I think it probably cut both ways, positively and negatively, and on average, probably came out in the wash. Because I think, as you've said, that he was probably given the benefit of the doubt in the beginning. But then once he found his footing, it's like, good, this is what we can expect of you, as we knew we could. And so if you cook less than that, it's like, I know you and you can do better than this. Do better. And so I do think it can cut both ways. But I think his performance shows that it was fine. You know, like, I just think that he did exactly as, even though he's very decorated and well known, I think he sort of did what we've seen people of the this caliber do. I think it's all fine. But yeah, I mean, your network is, they say it's in business, like, your network is your net worth. And so I'm not going to like fault him the benefit, but yeah.
Haley, what do you think the chances are that we're going to see an evolution in the way that Top Chef is cast? Do you think that after Bruce's time on the show, we might see, because, you know, when Brooke was on the show, she told us how she was the one who convinced Bruce to go on at the end of the day. Do you think after chefs have said, oh, Bruce Kalman was on Top Chef, do you think we might now be getting some quote unquote bigger names seeking out the show now?
I think it's possible, but I wouldn't think that production would want to stack that. I don't know, like, you could have one big name per season, but you wouldn't want like seven people who are just like, oh yeah, we're already super famous, the judges already know us. Like, I think it's a little weird almost. I don't know. I could see that they would bring someone back like Bruce, but I don't think they'll ever be able to replicate what Bruce was on this show.
Well, Bruce walks into Last Chance Kitchen here, and we get the two-part finale of LCK. Before we get into it, Rourke, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, a bit early to be doing the finals for LCK, right? Usually they bring bring the LCK person back when there are only three people left in the competition. Now it seems like they're bringing someone in at the final five instead of the final four.
I trust your better memory of this. But that seems sort of fairer to me. That feels better.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that one of my issues with LCK is that, you know, when you do this Redemption Island survivor life thing and you bring someone back only a couple rounds before the end, it means that, oh, they only need to cook a couple of dishes to make their way to the end. I think Kristen only needs to, I mean, Kristen's fantastic, but I think she only needs to cook through one challenge to make her way into the finals. So I will agree that I think it's more fair this way to bring someone back at the final five. I am intrigued though, Haley. So they said that this is the finals. Are we expecting them to go from five to four to three to two all the way through the rest of the season and call that the quote unquote finals? Or do you think we're going to get a final three this season?
Ooh, I would like, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. Yeah, I think we might get a final three. Wouldn't that be something different?
That would be interesting because we haven't seen that since season seven, since pre-All-Stars. They've stuck with final twos no matter how big the cast was. I don't know how I feel about it. I guess if I like the final three, that might sort of color my opinions a bit. But it does sort of seem like a bit of work set. It probably makes for fairer scheduling, but it's a bit of an odd scheduling if they have like four rounds that they call the finals. That might seem a bit too extravagant to me personally.
Oh, episode 11 is called Cooking High.
Oh, all right. There we go. It's happening. Rourke's finally getting her requested. If only this show went 420 episodes, wow, then it would have really found its moment. Well, so let's get into LCK here. So it's the two-part finale. Someone will be going back into the competition right there, right then. But first, they need to winnow down from 3 to 2. Haley, can you explain what the first part of the LCK finale was this week?
This was kind of funny because so we had Bruce and Joe and Brother. And so Tom was like, oh, so you guys are the Bears. And Brother was like, actually, I'm not one of what you're talking about. And Tom goes, who cares? We'll have a bear themed challenge. Let's make some porridge, folks.
Yeah, I love that Brother said somehow I got roped into this bear story, though.
Because I'm a big dude. Like,
well, I mean, also Brother Bear just sounds too perfect, too.
Yeah.
All of us Berenstain Bear fans or Berenstain Bear fans out there. I also liked how Tom's like, okay, we're going to go with a themed dish. I think it was Brother who said honey. And Joe said, oh, bear? And Tom's like, what is wrong with you? No, we're not cooking bear. We're eating porridge.
Like, why are we going into the nursery rhyme well so much?
I don't know. Yeah, we had Miss Muffet. We had this. I don't know what others. Maybe we'll be, I mean, this is the end of LCK. We might have gone into some Mother Goose, literally, if they kept going with it. Rourke, I'd be intrigued to hear from you. What are your thoughts towards LCK as a general concept? Are you on the Josh Wiggler spectrum of things, or are you on the, I guess, the Jim side of things?
So I'm guessing, so I know Josh is like really against it. So I'm guessing Jim's is like generally pro.
I would say, so. I mean, he's also was a participant in it, so that might again color his opinions a bit, but that's sort of the spectrum that I just put it on right here, right now.
So I would say that, I mean, props, I would say like good job to Top Chef and Bravo for creating what I think is probably the most successful online corollary to a show. I think they have done a really nice job with it, just like from a production standpoint. I think I don't mind the idea of people coming back because of the sort of like one, because of what can happen with sort of like one night only, where this like really amazing person has a slip up. So I don't hate that. I enjoy the peanut gallery because you get to see some of the personalities. I guess I'm like generally pro. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, Haley, you know, The Bachelor and ABC like abuses us to no end and just demands that we watch like 8 hours a week of their stupid content. Mm-hmm. And
you're
so,
telling me we're having a big week. Come on up.
Exactly. And so I generally don't like it when things make me go out of my way to be aware of what's going on. But I don't hate the concept, but it's sort of the audacity where it's like, just come on.
Well, some, one of them will come on back to the show. So if that's any
oh my God.
Indication.
Wow. What a transition.
Oh yeah. I'm the king of them. Haley, going towards this porridge challenge in particular, of the three porridges that came out, did any stand out to you for good or bad reasons?
TBH, I can't remember any of the three of them, and I watched it at 1 o'clock, and we're at about 3:38 right now. I don't remember what they were.
I'll fill in your memory blanks just a tiny bit here. So Bruce went for a farro and barley porridge with a scallop and a poached egg, pickled mustard green, and wild mushroom. So I actually, interestingly enough, had something very similar to this porridge when I was at the Three Bears dinner. There was a three porridge course, and now I guess I know who made the farro and barley porridge that I had. This one didn't have the scallop on it, which I guess makes sense because Tom had said the one critique behind Bruce's dish was that the scallop got a little lost, so maybe he felt like he didn't necessarily need it. But yeah, this might be the first time that I've eaten a dish that was on Top Chef. It's a little surreal. Rourke, did any of these other two between Brother's white quinoa porridge with the cranberry apple chutney, or Flam, as the lower third put it, his seared steak and barley porridge, did either one of those two stand out to you?
All right, so I have a disclosure. And it is that I watch on the Bravo Now app on my Roku. And after the episode, it was like, stay up to date, watch Last Chance Kitchen. And so I clicked it and I was like, why is Bruce already in the peanut gallery?
No.
And so I just watched that one and I was like, okay, that was weird. Did he like opt out? And so I just missed this one.
But I watched the next. I'm ready for the next one, though.
So you think Bruce just tapped out behind the scenes? Like, nope, I'm
good. I don't know.
I don't need to come back.
I was like, but he's still wearing a chef jacket. I was like, he seems ready to go. Maybe they're going to bring him in.
He's waiting on the sidelines, right?
Yeah.
Put me in, Tom. Oh, yeah. So I'll yada yada through this then. So, yeah. So brother does this really interesting combination of putting sea bass with cranberry apple chutney in with the porridge, and he brulees the top of the porridge. Like, on paper, all of those mixtures of taste shouldn't work, but it ends up being Tom's favorite, just because there's lots and lots of contrast. There's a lot of capriciousness going on, apparently. Flam gets by. There's a bit of his own little time crunch where he was actually about to pull a Bruce and not cook his barley in time, but apparently it just got perfectly cooked. So Bruce... I'm sure you knew this already, Rourke, answering your own little mystery. Bruce is eliminated here. Yeah, so now we have a showdown between Joe Flam and brother. No strings attached, no theming, just cook whatever you want. And it's interesting to see where they go. Brother says, you know what? I have gotten by on cooking some really interesting techniques. I'm going to throw as much onto this plate as possible. Joe Flam says, I'm going to go for something that's a lot simpler and a lot more refined. Brother decides to highlight a chicken breast with pecorino and jalapeno, roasted chili apple, butternut squash and Brussels sprouts hash, and a lime cream with raspberries with liquid nitro poured on them. And then Flam finishes off with a lamb shoulder with a fava bean pesto, charred fava beans, a pecorino, a shallot, and a balsamic glaze. They also are doing things a little differently to bring somebody back. Usually it's just Tom determining, but there are three total votes. Tom is one vote. The general peanut gallery is one cumulative vote. And Lachlan, apparently the favorite guest judge from this season, including bringing his son on for a couple of episodes, was the guest judge as well. Looking at these dishes, since I know you watched this episode, Rourke, of these two, just make a prediction right now. Who do you think is coming back from LCK?
I'm just going to say Flam because I like him. I want him. I think brother is a little, especially in Last Chance Kitchen, I think he has been a little arrogant, and I haven't liked his like attitude in Last Chance Kitchen very much. And then I also was just thinking about this, how you said earlier that the theme of the season was simplicity. And I also think a corollary to that is the theme being Leanne's quote when she is rejoins them for the one episode where she says, if you put six things on a plate, you're accountable for six things.
Mm.
And so he is. So brother is accountable for a lot. And the same way that Fatima joined the audience because hers was delicious, but she didn't chop up her steak. You know, he could, because his hash was a little soggy, you know? So I just think there's a little bit more risk there. So I'm going to say Flam.
What about you, Haley?
I just want to first point out Fatima's amazing peanut gallery shirt, which is a white button down with cat faces all over it. Like, and not just cartoon cats, like real cats. Like, it was fantastic. And I want to know where she got that so I can get one for myself. This one was a little weird for me. Like, I could understand why either one of them were made it to the finale, made it back into Top Chef. It seemed like they liked brother's dish better. They seemed to have some problems with the lamb, but like chicken breast, white chicken breast for, you know, your last quick fire challenge seems like an interesting choice. I guess you could do a lot with it, but that probably wouldn't be what I'd pick. And I thought it was really interesting when Tom and Lachlan went to the fridge and was like, oh, out of all of these things, they picked lamb shoulder and chicken breast. So I'm going to put my $2 in a coin form, aka a toonie, on brother.
Yeah, I'm really torn here too, because from a story perspective, I could see either one of them coming back. And part of me would say, you know, like, does brother's story feel complete if he doesn't make it back from Last Chance Kitchen? But then I think of somebody like Jason from a couple seasons ago who did really, really well to the point of where we had been championing on the podcast. Okay, when Jason comes back, he's going to do this. And nope, he falls short right at the end. So there's been precedent for it before. I'm gonna say I love Brother, and I think that the dish that he put out is super interesting. It's clear that he's very talented in bringing a bunch of different contrasts that in a very Katsuji-like way that sound like they don't make sense into one cohesive dish. But I might have to give the edge to Flame here just because, I don't know, I feel like the way he was eliminated, he keeps saying about how, you know, he has unfinished business. This really does feel like he has unfinished business, and I could see him coming back, and I could see him legitimately winning at this point. It's crazy to say that, like, after Brooke won last season, that anyone for a while would be able to come back from LCK and take it. But again, everyone is so varied, and Joe Flam is such a talented chef that I think he has a pretty fighting chance at it. So I might have to give the slight edge to Flam. So between our three votes, Flam would come back, but it's not our three votes that matters. It's their three votes. I also find it interesting. We don't know who the winner is, but Tom also said it's unanimous. I don't know if that means things one way or the other, but I did think it was interesting that everyone thought one dish was better than the other. But we shall see as next week, Brother or Joe Flam rejoins the competition. They're in Telluride for the finals. Rourke, how do you feel about, I mentioned this before, about them not really going to anywhere, to Alaska or Hawaii or Vancouver or Mexico, that they're staying in Colorado but going to a different place?
I feel fine with that. I think that, Haley, I think you said this last week that you had thought the season was going to be more like California season, where they kind of bopped around. They did like Palm Springs, San Francisco. And so this, you know, here they bop. And it doesn't bother me that it's local. Telluride is absolutely beautiful. And it's all good by me. I'm not super picky about like that stuff.
I love travel porn, but I am not offended by them staying in Colorado.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that, as we talked about, I think there are still some things that they can do. And it's clear that they have seen some really beautiful things and some really fun things in Colorado. But I still feel like there's some things that they're able to embrace. So I'd rather them take those opportunities and say, OK, we're flying to Jamaica for the finals. And it also, you know, helps them account. It makes sure that they all sort of film in one stretch instead of it seems like what they usually do, which is, hey, let's do the regular season, take a break, and then fly to the finals location. It sort of makes everything go in one fell swoop. And we will keep going in one fell swoop as well as we continue to cover the beginning of the finals of this season of Top Chef. Rourke, thank you so, so much for coming on. It was great to learn about your history with Top Chef, about your worst nightmare. Hopefully doing this podcast and not end up being your worst nightmare, but it was so much fun to have you on.
It was such a pleasure to join you guys. Thank you.
Of course. How can people follow you on social media to catch up on whatever's going on in the life of Rourke?
The only thing I really tweet about is The Bachelor. And then sometimes like a funny text from a friend, but I'm pretty dull online, so no hard feelings. But my Twitter handle is Rourke's Tweets. And funnily enough, I actually like accrue followers throughout the week. And then I like do the one thing that I do online, which is tweet The Bachelor, and I lose followers. It's a great cycle.
Yeah, it's a very vicious cycle. But I guess if you get used to it, hopefully it doesn't become too devastating as it happens.
Oh, yeah. No. My self-esteem is not attached to that at all.
I used to go through that, too, before people were like, oh, this is just what she does. I had one person tell me one time, like, hey, you should really make a separate account for your Bachelor tweets. And I said, oh, yeah, here it is. And I sent them a link to just my Twitter account. And I was
like, oh, that's really funny.
It's like, F you. Like, this is my Twitter account. I get to do what I want here. So if you want to unfollow from Bachelor tweets, you're making a bad choice. What you really should do is mute on Monday nights.
Yeah, that's totally a viable option.
Mute on Mondays. That's like, that's very snappy, very alliterative. I feel like that works. Haley, how can people follow you on your aforementioned social media platforms? And I know you said that you've got some big weeks coming up in the Bachelorverse.
Do we ever? So, okay. So there, I feel like a regular Mike Bloom with all the content I have out. So a couple weeks ago, Akiva Winokur and I, we did a podcast about the Olympics and Brent Wolgamott came and joined us for a segment of that. So that is out if you're interested in watching or listening to a podcast about the Olympics. Some of the stuff we said is probably outdated already, but whatever. Listen to us for 2.5 hours. This the next coming 2 weeks, we have the Bachelor Winter Games going on. So that's in addition to the 2 hours a week that we already watch The Bachelor, there's going to be 4 hours extra of Bachelor Winter Games. So Amy and I are going to be doing our regular Bachelor podcast coverage.
My worst nightmare is Mike Fleiss.
That's a good one. How would you represent that on a dish?
Just a angry red man.
Fair.
Made out of marzipan?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then so we'll be having special guests join us for our extra Winter Games coverage, so keep your eyes out for that. And there's another fun special podcast coming next weekend, I believe, that I might be featured on, and someone else on this podcast might be featured on, so just keep your eyes out for that, and your ears, I guess. And social media, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @8strong_.
And you can always follow me at @MikeBloomType. I guess I am by default putting out a Mike Bloom level of content, if that makes sense. I'm covering RuPaul's Drag Race, as always, with Leona Boris and Brent Wolgamott. I'm doing podcasts and exit press for The Amazing Race. Check out my Top Chef exit interviews if you haven't yet for Parade. I got to speak with Bruce a couple days ago. He gives some really interesting insight as to his own opinions to what we were speaking about before, as to whether he felt like it was an advantage or a disadvantage, how well-known he was, what exactly was going through his head the night Jude was born. He gave me an update on Jude. That was a great interview with Bruce. I'm also doing exit press for Celebrity Big Brother, so be sure to check all of that out. And as Haley alluded to, there might be some other wrap up stuff related coming in the near future. Make sure you're subscribed to that, as well as our Top Chef only feed. I know we're getting to the last few episodes of the season, but of course any subscription as well as a rating and review are greatly, greatly appreciated. If we're talking about a hashtag to finish things off, I mean, I have Scheduled Cry is a good one. I like Pasta Yips. I feel like that was a fun one that Rourke threw in there too. I'm not picky though, so if either of you have a preference.
Scheduled Cry.
Oh, I was gonna say pasta. Shoot. I don't care.
Rourke, you're the guest. We're going to defer to you on this one. Apologies, Haley. I think Pasta Yips is fun. But I do like this idea of a Scheduled Cry. I'd love to hear from everyone else as to what they might be using as their own Scheduled Cry. Maybe it's a part of Top Chef. But Rourke, again, thank you so much for coming on. This was so much fun. We'll be back next week to keep breaking down this season of Top Chef as it heads to Telluride in the final phase. For now, you may pack your knives and go.